We will start this morning's calendar with the case of Price v. State. Mr. Coyer, Ms. Clowers, are you ready to proceed? Very well. 64281, Price v. State.
Justice Seda, Justice Givens, Justice Pickering, good morning. I have asked to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal, if I may. And may it please the court, my name is Gregory Coyer, and I represent the appellant, Edmund Paul Price. I would like to begin, if I may, by jumping right into the substance of what I believe is the most important and most dispositive issue in this case, and that is whether or not the state violated NRS 178.620, which is commonly referred to as the Interstate Agreement on Detainers, or IAD statute. Specifically, the state ran afoul of Articles 3 and 5 of the IAD by failing to bring Mr. Price to trial within the 180-day time period that is applicable. I can tell you that I've calculated these time frames, more than a dozen different ways. And I can represent to this court that under the most respondent favorable calculations that can possibly be made, there is no doubt that the state exceeded the 180 days permitted to bring Mr. Price to trial. By way of a little background, Mr. Price was serving a term of imprisonment in the state of California when he learned that there was an indictment pending against him in the state of Nevada. Accordingly, Price requested an Article 3, or prisoner-initiated transfer, to the state of Nevada for the purpose of resolving the outstanding indictment. In such a scenario, under the statute, California is referred to as the sending state, Nevada referred to as the receiving state. When an Article 3 request is made, the applicable 180-day period begins to run from the time that the receiving state, Nevada, receives Mr. Price's Article 3 request.
And that was April 29th, 2011?
That's correct.
Okay.
And there is no dispute that that is the operative date for starting the timeline. Mr. Price's jury trial began on May 20th, 2013, a span of 753 days. Given this expanse of time, the critical question is simply how many of those 753 days should be counted against Price and how many should be counted against the state. I would submit to this court that there are two segments of time that are arguably attributable to Price. The first segment is a period of time from September 22, 2011 to May 17, 2012. A span of 239 days. There's no dispute that on September 22nd, 2011, Mr. Price filed a motion to dismiss the indictment for failure to honor his statutory right to testify in front of the grand jury. Price's motion was denied by the trial court, but on October 20th, 2011, the trial court, at Price's request, granted a stay of the proceedings so that Price could appeal by way of extraordinary writ to this court the denial of his motion. That stay remained in place until May 17, 2012, when the trial court, Judge Bixler, dismissed the indictment against Price pursuant to the order of this court.
Why do you pick September 22nd as opposed to August 9th as the start date for the exclusion? I'm not sure it matters, but the record's unclear whether Price agreed to the continuance requested by Edelman, who was then his co-defendant?
That's correct. I agree. I don't think that it matters, and I conceded that time in my brief for the purpose of streamlining the argument.
Okay.
However,
so you're not trying to put that back in play necessarily?
I think legally it should be from September 22nd.
Okay, tell me why.
What I did in my brief was calculate the most respondent favorable calculations. Nevada, it follows the line that tolls the time period from the filing of a motion by the defendant if it causes a delay in the trial. The case authority is split as to whether or not agreeing to a co-defendant continuance can also toll the time. And again, it doesn't matter, but I think clearly we have to toll it from September 22nd, and we could arguably toll it from August 9th. It's an additional
4 days.
It won't matter in the big picture. The second segment of time that's arguably attributable to Price is from July 30th, 2012 to January 28th, 2013, a span of 183 days. Price requested a continuance of his trial on July 30th, 2012, because 2 business days prior to the start of his trial, the state essentially dropped a bombshell on the defense by disclosing that they had struck a secret deal with the co-defendant Edelman, placed her on the state's witness list untimely, would be transferring her to federal custody where she would be charged in the federal system and ultimately enter into a federal guilty plea, a very strange arrangement indeed. The trial court extremely reluctantly granted Price's request for a continuance, and it was on the condition that Price should have to waive the time during that period as it pertains to the IED calculation. I characterize this chunk of time as arguably attributable to Price only because of the reasoning in this court's own precedent of Snyder v. State, which is 103 Nevada 275. In Snyder, the defendant's trial was continued 7 times. This court found it prudent to analyze each and every continuance for the cause. The court found every single continuance attributable to the defendant except for one. The one delay not attributable to the defendant in Snyder was actually a defense request for a continuance, where on the eve of trial, the state changed the nature of its prosecution strategy to such a degree that it caused the defense attorney to request the continuance, an almost identical set of facts that we have here today. In the words of this court, quote, although the delay could technically be attributed to the defendant, we agree that this time should not be charged to him. The state's late filing left counsel with little choice, end quote. So I would submit to this court that even time from July 30th, 2012 to January 28th, 2013 should not be attributed to Price, and I believe Snyder supports this proposition. I would note, as Justice Pickering asked before, that in the big picture, this period of time doesn't matter. It's not necessary for this court to agree with me that Snyder controls that segment of time.
But your point is this is like Snyder in that regard because the plea deal in federal court with Edelman was attributable to some last-minute surprise that the state sprang on you? I mean, is that your point?
That's exactly my point, yes. It was essentially where the defense had absolutely no choice, much like they did in Snyder, and the court agreed. And they said, what was defense counsel to do? That segment of time...
Right, but in Snyder, they did... The state's delay was not as much out of their control as I don't know that the state controls what the federal government does.
Well, the state doesn't control what the federal government does, but in this case, the state did control whether or not Ms. Edelman was transferred to federal custody and charged.
Okay.
That wasn't something that just happened. That was an agreement or collusion, if you will, between the state prosecutor and the federal prosecutor.
How do we know that?
Because it was done at Edelman's request and at the state's request. It wasn't that the feds stepped in and took the case. It
was you used the word collusion, I think, I heard you say.
Sure.
Collusion between?
Sure, and it was because that the particular federal prosecutor is someone that the state prosecutor knows very well and that they worked together, and essentially I think the state prosecutor agreed, got the federal prosecutor to agree to
this. None of which is a part of our record.
I don't know that that's reflected in the record or not, to be honest with you. But it's clear in the record that the state initiated this process of putting Edelman in the federal system.
Mr. Cork, can you talk a little bit about, we have a lot of issues here. I'm interested in this Owens testimony regarding secondhand gold sales and how that was admissible and, or not admissible in your point of view.
Thank you, Justice. That particular issue was a real shock to me that the trial court allowed under the habit statute, the habit or routine practice of an organization allowed another individual to just basically come in and testify, not in an expert capacity, mind you, just come in and testify that, you know, that everything that the victim in this case did was totally reasonable because that's just the way we do it in this industry. And I think that if that rule were upheld and applied in the civil context, it would so dramatically change the way civil cases are handled that it would really be a sea change in this state.
Let me ask you this. Let's say we agreed with you on that as far as the admissibility or inadmissibility of that testimony. Tell me why you don't think it would be harmless in view of the very strong case the state put on as to the guilt of Mr. Price.
Certainly. The prejudice was astronomical, and here's why. Because our entire defense strategy was This gentleman, Mr. Wall, the alleged victim, he cannot be trusted. You cannot trust what he has to say. He, you know, conducts himself in fictional persona. He does shady business deals. You know, this was our entire defense strategy. You can't believe what he says. And then the state calls in this witness, unrelated, to say, yeah, you can believe this guy because everything he did was legitimate under the routine practice of an industry. And it essentially vouched for the credibility of the alleged victim. And it was very devastating because our entire defense strategy was you can't believe this gentleman.
I'd like to return you to your timeline, and I'm sorry we're jumping you around a bit. You then would put at the state's footsteps, at the state's feet, the January 28, 2013 to the May 20 trial date. Tell me why we should count that time against the state.
Because of essentially the exact reasoning that the Snyder Court gave. Even though it was a defense request for a continuance, defense had little choice given the context. The state altered the landscape of the prosecution, changed strategy.
Well, wait, January 28, 2013, you asked for the continuance or the state asked for the continuance?
I'm sorry, you're asking about January 28th moving forward.
You didn't finish your last segment.
January 28th, Edmund Price was ready to go to trial.
Yes, that's my understanding.
The state, in that instance, filed an emergency writ, an emergency petition, an emergency motion for stay that was granted. During that stay, Price lost that trial date. So when we came back on January 31st, we were there to pick a new trial date. The defense requested February 11th and February 25th, both dates that the court had offered up as available. The prosecutor said, no, no, absolutely not. Our trial schedules won't allow for that, so we want a date in May. So the period from January 28th until May 20th, there's just no way you can attribute that to Price because it was only eaten up because of the prosecutor's trial schedules.
Are you faulting the adequacy of the record on the demonstration of good cause or reasonable cause for the continuance by the state?
Absolutely. The court, unfortunately, never made specific findings regarding good cause. And the state can't point to, and the trial court didn't rely on, any case law that says that a prosecutor's trial schedule can constitute good cause under the IED. It's just not there. The authority's not there. So here Edmund Price is ready to go to trial on January 28th. He's ready to go to trial on February 11th or February 25th. The prosecutors don't allow that to happen. We end up set for trial in May.
Kentucky, I think, remanded a similar situation for a hearing on good causes. Can you tell me quickly, and I'll ask Justice Sata to give you another minute or two, why that would be inadequate?
Why remanding for a hearing on good
causes? Yeah, it's not something this court should do.
I think we're going to ultimately end up right back here in front of this court, and I think this court can make that determination by simply looking at the record that we have. I think the record as it stands is more than adequate.
Thank you.
And because of the timing of the question, I'll give you your full 3 minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you. I appreciate that, Justice.
Thank you, Justice Sanders.
Good morning. May it please the Court. Shannon Clowers, Deputy District Attorney. I was also trial counsel in this case. I will start by addressing the Owens issue so I can just get it out of the way for you, Justice Givens. We were very careful when we did and presented the testimony of Jessica Owens, and the main purpose was to rebut the defense's allegations that the victim's behavior in this case was somehow abnormal or disingenuous when he did, in fact, bring a dolly and some chemicals and testing equipment to a sale that took place in a hotel room where he brought over $100,000 in cash. And so what we were doing was simply establishing by presenting Jessica Owens, who'd worked in the industry, asking her questions, how do deals in the precious metals go down? Do they go down in hotel rooms? Yes, they do. Oftentimes, do you bring scales, dollies, and things like this? Yes, we do. We never once asked her about Mr. Wall. We never once asked her about the instant case. What we were simply doing was presenting relevant evidence to the jury to establish so they understood how that process worked. It would have been the same had we asked a detective, how do drug deals go down? Because we're going to presume that not all juries are familiar with the sales of precious metals. And so I don't believe that we went outside of the NRS for the habit portion at all. And I think that if we change that, that would severely affect how civil attorneys do use that. And I believe the one case was the Thomas case from 2010 in Nevada, where what it was used as was to say that the doctor did what he normally would have done, and that stayed in conformity with what they expected him to do.
Yeah, but that was a very narrow holding, and it was specific to that doctor and his chart. I'm troubled by the expansion of habit evidence and no expert designation. You're trying to say this is the norm in this industry, and the record appears to say this industry is, like, very eccentric. I'm troubled by using...
That's a very good word for this industry, would be eccentric. It's not done in normal ways, which, you know, we learned throughout the process of going through the evidence of how precious metal deals are done. And we didn't use her as an expert. We never asked an opinion or anything of that nature. We simply wanted her to come in and say, these are how deals are done, just as I use the example of how drug deals are done or something of that nature. And so I don't believe that we expanded it. I believe we were very limited, especially by not asking her any questions regarding Mr. Wall or the case at hand. We asked her no opinion about what she thought about what happened in that hotel room that day. And with that, I would like to move on to the IAD issue. I will note that there were five trial settings in this particular case, and the state did announce ready for, and I would say for the fifth trial date as well. And what happened on the fifth trial date was that the court continued the case, indicating that this court would not act quick enough on the emergency writ that we had filed approximately, I believe, January 24th. You guys responded actually on January 25th, granting the writ. So we could have gone to trial on that particular January 28th trial date, and the state was ready, and so was the defense. It was the court that then stayed the case pending your decision. Once the decision came down, we came back before the court on January 31st of 2013. At that point, the trial court wanted us to go to trial 11 days after, and from your experience here and from your experience prior to this, everybody knows that it's very impossible for the state to then get all the witnesses ready, which was on the record, to then present the case 11 days later or 25 days later for that matter, because when trials are set, especially with certain prosecutors, they do have other cases. In this case, it was Mr. Stanton and myself, and we ended up having to split the case up by the time May 20th came and I tried the case with a different deputy. And the court...
But the problem on this record is there's not much of a... Well, first of all, do you dispute the calculation of the time leading up to this? I'm going to want to hear from you on those points. But it's worrisome to me that we have such a skimpy record on this continuance. And you look at it and Mr. Stanton's competing child murder trial commitment is good cause, but Mr. Stanton doesn't try the case. He doesn't end up trying the case. You do.
Yes.
And there's nothing about your calendar on this record. And so I'm hard-pressed to say that it's the burden of the state when it's asking for an extension to demonstrate that, and the record is fairly sketchy on that.
And I would say that the record is somewhat thin in that area, especially on the January 31st date. I will note that we did discuss my trial schedule as well during that time, and I was scheduled to be in another trial.
Is that on the record?
I do believe so.
Do you have a cite for that?
I know that it's in Volume 4, around page 400. I don't have the exact cite, so I do apologize. It's either at the end of Volume 3 of the appellant's appendix or at the beginning of Volume 4. I don't dispute that the IAD began on April 29th of 2011. I do dispute that it stops and it begins tolling on August 9th of 2011 because the court minutes will reflect that Price requested a short continuance because he planned on filing a habeas corpus petition.
So you would run April 29th to August 9th?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Justice Pickering, and I would say that that's approximately 103 days. I do not agree that, or I do agree that from June 14th, 2012 to July 6th of 2012 that the time stops tolling and it begins calculating again for 22 days. June 6, 2012, particularly because the defendant filed a writ of habeas corpus on that day, and according to the IAD, if he acts in contradiction with the IAD, then the time tolls. And I would submit to you that filing a petition, a writ of habeas corpus, does in fact do that. The next issue is the July 30th, 2012 to January 28th of 2013. I guess what I heard this morning is that the defendant was basically coerced because the state presented a plea agreement with the feds. And to answer one of the questions, the state did have the case intentionally transferred to the federal government. I do believe some of that is part of the record, not all of which is. And it was also placed on the record that the reason we had her transferred to the federal government was because of her fear of the defendant. And it also, that's the reason it took so long for the proffer and the agreement between the parties to come together, was one, transferring the jurisdictions, and two, her fear. And that is a part of the record. And so in every single case, it should be presumed, and it is presumed when there's co-defendants, that one co-defendant could testify against the other. And she was timely noticed. And in addition, at this point, their cases had actually been severed. So there's always the assumption that, in fact, she is going to testify or a co-defendant is going to testify against somebody. So I submit that it wasn't some ambush on behalf of the state so that we could go ahead and throw a wrench into the entire process. The state was always fully aware of the IED, even from the very first arraignment date back in 2011.
Let me pause you for just a moment. If we run April 29th to August 9th, that's 102 or 103 days.
Yes, Your
Honor. And then it picks up again. The Markham dismissal occurs, and then he's reindicted on June 14th. He's arraigned of 2012. That runs until on June 14th, the time clock starts running again. Trial set for July 30th, so that time gets counted at towards the 180 days, and that's another 46 days, right?
Well, I submit to you that it stops on July 6th when he files the writ for petition of habeas corpus.
But I thought that the... Okay, I see what you're saying.
And may I continue?
Yes, I'm sorry.
Thank you. And therefore, I under no circumstances can the July 30th, 2012 to January 28th of 2013 be attributable to the state. Then I would submit to you that from January 28th, 2013 to January 31st, 2013, where there was a three-day delay in what Judge Bixler was going to do, it's another 3 days. I would say that that does go towards the time, towards the 180 days for 3 days. And then I would state that on January 31st of 2013, although the record is skimpy, that the court exercised, there's two ways I would essentially submit to you that you can pause or toll the time under the IED. One is the defendant's actions, and two is if the court finds good cause. And I submit to you at that time there was. It was mentioned both my trial schedule and Mr. Stanton's trial schedule. His being more important, obviously, because I'm the one that ended up trying the case. But also, there, everybody, I believe, knows that the district courts go from a criminal calendar for a certain period of time to a civil calendar for a certain period of time. And the May 20th date was the first one available when he had to transition from his civil back to his criminal. So I would state that that time cannot be attributable to the state. The state was, in fact, ready to go. The court kept issuing inconsistent orders for us to comply with that we were unable to comply with, which is why we came to the Supreme Court, and we ultimately prevailed on that issue. We could have gone to trial at that time as well, but I do believe that there was most certainly good cause It's a little inconceivable to think that the state can turn around and be ready to go to trial in 11 days or 25 days, especially in a case of this caliber.
Was there any discussion by the judge ever sending the case to overflow when he had civil cases or whatever to do during this time period?
No, not in this particular case, and the defense never requested it. There had already been so much litigation and so many things that had gone on, and because the trial was going to last more than a week, it wouldn't have been something that I believe either party would have requested at that time. There did come a time where we requested on behalf of the state to recuse Judge Bixler, but it had nothing to do with that. It had to do with some comments that he had made on the record, nothing to do with us again trying to stall the case, because there truly was no reason for the state to try to stall the case. And I would also point out that during that time between January 31st and the trial date of May 20th, the defense continued to litigate the case and continued to create issues that would have stalled the case from going to trial anyways. As you know, Justice Gibbons, you wrote another decision in relation to this case where the defense was trying to subpoena the defense attorneys to come and testify and say what their client told us during the proffer. And so that also would have delayed the trial. They wouldn't have been ready to go at the point in time on either February 11th or February 20th or 25th.
I'm looking at a couple of pages of the transcript in Volume 4, which is around pages 410 to 411, and there's an exchange where the court says, I was hoping the 25th of February was going to be our trial date, but you can't do it on the 25th, Mr. Stanton. That's correct, and neither can Ms. Clowers. And it continues. That, I will tell you, is all I see in this record about your unavailability and why.
Yes.
Do you have anything else in mind?
No, there was a further motion to dismiss that was filed in April, and I do believe there was another hearing then, and Judge Bixler then also made the ruling that he was not going to dismiss it, that there was good cause found for the continuance previously from January 31st.
So the good cause was and remains trial schedules of the two prosecutors, correct?
Yes, but I would also submit to you, Justice Seda, that it also had to do with the trial court schedule based upon the fact that it had to go civil for, I think it's 2 months or 6 weeks or something.
And is that in the record?
I don't believe that that's in the record.
Because this here's the troubling fact I think that we all share, and that is, you know, we certainly have familiarity with the nature of the 8th Judicial District Trial Court's schedule. And we recognize, obviously, that the prosecutor's office has the same situation with a burdensome caseload. But this is a type of provision, the IAD is one where timing is real important. And I am concerned about the record, or lack of record, as Justice Pickering has pointed out in this case, that, with all due respect, looks like a flyby to me. It looks like, you know, well, you're going to be in trial, and you're going to be in trial, and apparently there's nobody else that can try this case, and so we're going to move it. I'm not sure that makes out good cause under what we know about the IAD, and that's my concern.
And I understand that, Justice Ada, but I would submit that forcing the state to go to trial 11 days or 25 days after a setting, it makes it nearly impossible based upon the things that the state has to do to prepare for the trial, including subpoenaing and bringing in out-of-state witnesses. We had medical doctors and other witnesses.
But you already had all those witnesses under subpoena for the January 25th trial date, correct?
Yes.
Question right out of my mouth. Mm-hmm.
Sorry.
No. It's exactly, that's our concern. I think we share that same concern.
Yeah, I think we're all very uneasy with the record on this. So if you have anything else to add on that, it would be helpful.
I would just submit that if you don't believe that the record is sufficient, that the best course of action would be to remand it back to have an evidentiary hearing on the good cause or lack thereof for the continuance from the January 31st to the May 20th date. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Counsel in rebuttal. And I guess I'm going to start where we left off, knowing the burdensome caseload that the district court has in the 8th Judicial District, as well as the concurrent schedule of that prosecutor's office. Why isn't what we have in this record adequate to show good cause and to get around the 180-day dilemma?
Thank you. To answer that question, I would draw this court's attention to Brown versus Wolf, 706 F. 2nd 902. It is a Ninth Circuit case that is interpreting the Nevada IAD. And in that case, the court stated, we conclude that court congestion may, in some circumstances, constitute good cause for continuance under the IAD, but the requisite level of congestion was not shown here. Quote, the IAD does not by its own terms define good cause, nor do the various legislative histories of the original drafting of the IAD by the Joint Committee and the adoption of the IAD shed any light on whether congestion is good cause. However, I'm skipping forward now two sentences. Where the trial judge has not attempted to transfer the case to another judge or to adjust or increase the criminal calendar, the weight of authority supports the view that the court is not sufficiently congested to constitute good cause for extension. Accordingly, the indictment should be dismissed. So the record does not show what did not happen, and it wouldn't. Judge Bixler did not make any effort to give the, as the court noted, to give the case to another judge. In fact, at one point he stated, no, I have to try this case.
Did either side ask it to be sent to overflow to another judge?
I do not recall that either side asked. I think by the time January and February had rolled around, Mr. Price was so eager to go to trial, he would have been willing to see that happen. But I don't think the record speaks to that.
Let me ask you this. I know time is short. I'm concerned about this issue of your client filing for the petition of writ of habeas corpus. Doesn't that suspend the time forward while that petition is pending?
Absolutely not. Here is okay. The issue. Only when it causes a delay in the trial. We don't want to discourage defendants to litigate their cases or to fight for their rights. But when they file something and their filing causes the trial date to be lost, then absolutely, that time counts against them. But when you litigate your case within the time frames and it doesn't cause a trial date to be lost, there's no reasonable explanation or legal authority for why that should stop the clock. And I think Brown versus Wolf speaks to that as well. That's where the language comes from, that someone who acts contrary to the IAD can waive their rights under the IAD. But if you read on, they say, but only for the purpose, only for the period of time that's attributable to the delay caused by the defendant. So simply filing a motion, you know, in January that gets disposed of in February, that's not going to do anything to a May trial date. There's no reason why any of that time should be counted against Mr. Price. There's no authority for it.
Well, why isn't the demonstration, thin though it is, of both counsel's trial calendars sufficient to establish good cause on a deferential review by us? I'm sorry.
May I respond? Because you would essentially be acknowledging that the prosecutors are held to a much lower standard than the trial court. And Brown versus Wolf at least gives us some idea of what a court must do to constitute good cause for court congestion. To hold the prosecutors, who are the ones bound by the IAD timeframe, to a lesser standard than even that which is in Brown versus Wolf, I think would absolutely defeat the purpose of the IAD statute.
Thank you.
Thank you both. Mr. Cower, Ms. Powers, thank you so much for your time. This matter will stand submitted.